Today we're going to talk about fouling our nest. And I've structured it so that after an introduction which varies in length, depending on how many stories I can recall, we then go into solids to discuss our solid waste, our liquid wastes, including in this case thermal pollution, which is a kind of an in thing now, and gases. And when we get to gases, we should talk a little bit about pesticides, because I know you'll bring it up. I'll also bring in a bit about noise, noise pollution. And then we'll sort of talk about maybe how we got here in this kind of unfortunate situation. And then how do we get out of it? Now, there's several in the audience who are involved in this kind of business. Some of you full-time, some part-time. Yeah, I've talked to at least three of you about it. Others will want to contribute as we go in here, as we go through. If you have anything you want to bring up at any time, don't hesitate to interrupt. You know. I've been involved in an interesting discussion on a nuclear war at Princeton over a period of time. It's sponsored by the New York Academy of Sciences, and we have a core group. There's about 25 of us sit around tables for several days, and the mode of the day is interruption, you know. And I think it's useful to do that. Well, if I'm in the middle of a joke or an alleged witticism or a poem, don't interrupt then. Wait till I finish. And to begin with, I think it's appropriate to go back to some earlier writers, and I recall something that Dickens said in A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. And I think this sort of describes our present situation. Shelley said that hell is a city much like London, a populous and smoky city. And since that time, we've gotten a lot more of them. Now, I know that our whole economy seems to be based sort of on our developments in technology. When I was first entered the field of science, because we knew how to do something, we had to do it. Or if we discovered something, boy, you got to go through with it. If you discover a new method, try it, you see. Science and technology are really great paradoxes. As Dickens has pointed out here, we can apply it to that. They are at once our bane and our blessing, a wellspring of our aspirations, yet a threat to our well-being. Technology is both a social benefactor and a social calamity. And I think then that we can sort of go into the solid waste immediately. Well, except probably a little more on the science and technology bit. Often I tell a story here. These three fellows, Tom, Jim, and Clara, were going down to the railroad station. It's some time ago, you see. They don't do that much anymore, but they had to catch a certain train. One of them had to catch a certain train. And the train was a little late and they were a little early, so they decided, as the unfortunate custom is now, that they went in to have a couple of tall ones. And they had a couple of double martinis. And by the time they sort of turned around, the train was in. In fact, it was about leaving. And so they all ran for the train. Now, Tom and Jim caught the train, but Carl missed it. And he was standing there sort of dejectedly, and the train master came up and or the station master came up and he put his arm around sort of and says, sorry about that old boy.
There'll be another one, you know, maybe tomorrow or whatever it was. And he says, don't feel sorry for me. He says, Tom and Jim are on that train and they came down here to see me off. And that sort of describes our situation, really. I mean, we're like Tom and Jim. We're on a train that we're not so sure that we'd like to be on. And the unfortunate part of this train is that we don't quite know where it's taking us. It's gathering speed. There are many unknown switches, probably manned in part by demons. And there is no single scientist or technologist in the engine cab. And most of us are probably sitting in the caboose looking at where we've been. And that's part of this lecture. In the initial stages of it, we'll be talking about sort of where we've been. Fortunately, some of us are trying to communicate with those that are up front. And some of my activities have not exactly put me in the up near the front, but I have been involved in some things that sort of removed me from the caboose. My activities have been more in the field of radiation, but we have these other things related to it. But I'm not going to talk very much about radiation today, but I'm open to questions on it. On another occasion, later during my stay, we will discuss some of the peaceful application of nuclear energy and also the nuclear war, and we will then get into some of the contamination or potential contamination from this. But I think many of us sort of feel, you know, we have some sympathy for the old lady. When the space age came, you know, she says, why do we have to think about going into space when God meant us to stay here on Earth and watch TV? You know? And that's sort of how it is. Now, our economy is principally based on taking our natural resources, converting them into things for the consumer, selling them to him, and then forgetting about them. Now, there's a real hooker on this because, unfortunately, there are no consumers, only users. We have to begin closing the loop. Until very recently, our disposal system was based on throwing things away. But we are fast running out of aways. Huh? There aren't very many aways left. When Leif Erikson discovered this fair land, I think they still found some of his leavings. But the country could sort of absorb it. We're no longer in this position. And this is evident when we look at, for example, as we start out on our solid wastes. Our land pollution really staggers the imagination. And it's probably appropriate that we do it here. We can see just out to the windows here just what happens. Each person in this country today gets rid of 4.5 pounds of solid waste per day. This is 300 billion pounds per year for this country. And we're sort of running out of holes, you know, to put them in. 48 billion metal cans, 26 billion bottles and jars, 65 billion metal plastic and bottle caps, you know. And for a while, you know, we weren't so bad off because we were making paper containers. But we also made some out of tin. Well, the paper would decompose, sort of. The tin would rust away. But now we do much better. We make them out of aluminum or plastic, which are well nigh eternal. Now, if you burn the plastics, you got some poison gas. As the chancellor of our university said, we have an undramatic problem that needs a very dramatic approach in a very dramatic short period of time. And then we clutter up our highway. I get so angry every time I drive down the highway, you know, or even just a few miles to my home, you know. People, all the junk they throw off on the road. And also around Holden, you know. I'm finding candy wrappers on the trail out here and cans, and you better not do it in my presence because I'll probably read you off. Because we have receptacles for these things. And right now on our highways, do you know how much it costs us to clean up our highways, just a litter along the road? $2,500 per mile of highway. Well, that's a lot of expenditure. And now the cars also contribute to this. You know, we always think of cars as contributing, you know, just to the bad, some bad smell and various gases. But René Dubos, who's Rockefeller, told me last year that probably one of the greatest contributions to solid material in the air was the colloidal particles from brakes and tires of automobiles. And I had never thought of that before. So we have a real problem here. We'll talk more about the how to sort of what to do about it later. And there are some concrete things that are being done about it. Another thing is water contamination. And this we're having to, you know, I mean, I remember on our hometown, you know, we had this kind of unfortunate, there was a town up the river, you know, and we'd go up there and play in football or something, you know, and it used to be one of these things, you know, like you see in the restrooms, it says, remember to flush it because the next town down needs water, you know. Well, it's sort of that way, you know. I mean, we're drinking it five times over, sort of. A couple of years ago in the Northeast, you know, was absolutely dry. I mean, boy, they were really short of water. They couldn't water their lawns. In New York City, the Hudson River was flowing by at the rate of 30,000 gallons per second, but it was too filthy to be utilized. And you who are from around the Great Lakes, and I know, like Dr. Larson and I were talking last night, now this is represents a quarter of the world's supply of fresh water. The water levels are falling, the pollution is increasing. I don't have to tell you people about Lake Erie, which is probably the hardest hit. It's a dumping ground for sewage and industrial waste from four states and the province of Canada. In 1936, there were 20 million pounds of blue pike caught there. A couple of years ago, there was less than 1,000 pounds. It's a cesspool. And I don't know if it'll ever come back, you know. Maybe because of the turnover, because it's a smaller lake, maybe they can. But you're talking about many, many years. Lake Michigan is fast becoming polluted. Lake Superior is a real wonderful body of fresh water. But you're losing ground there. And Dr. Larson will probably have something to say about that when we get into sort of the corrective parts of it. Now what happens in these lakes is that, so you put sewage in, you say, well, that's sort of feeding the lake. And then there are detergents. And I hope you're using these biodegradable detergents. But this stuff fertilizes the algae, you consume the available oxygen, and that's the end of the fish, and then you've got sort of a green lake, you know. And it's a real mess. And it's happening, for example, in California mid-lakes, in Lake Tahoe, where Dr. Fuller is spending a lot of time. I mean, it's getting to be a real mess. Our sewage disposal system, or our sewage disposal situation, is a real mess. Right now, the sewage from over 50 million people is being discharged raw. The estimated cost of cleaning up the waters in this country right now, over the next probably two decades or three, is probably in the neighborhood of $75 billion. Now, if you can figure out, that's quite a bit per person. But that's the direction we have to go. And that's sort of why, you know, I usually save this button for my discussion and drug addiction. But it also applies here. The world is going to pot, you know. It's sort of and this button here, I should explain, you know. And it's sort of we who are in science and technology,
you know, it really applies to us. How can we lose when we're so sincere? We're trying to give you the things you want, you know. How can we lose, huh? We could go on the water situation. The only thing I'm going to say more about it is this thing of thermal pollution. And for some of you who will not be involved in the lecture on, the peacetime use of nuclear energy, as one looks ahead in the decades ahead, certainly nuclear power is coming in. Even if you don't want it, it almost has to come because of the depletion of our hydrocarbon fuels. And also that they should be saved probably for better things than burning. This is oil and coal, because we'll probably be eating it here in the not too distant future. And there's going to be an accumulation of this. Now, some of you in the Midwest, where you are putting in reactors, you realize that you have to have something that cools them. Or in many of your power plants, you have to have cooling water. All right, so you're going to end up heating up something. Well, what does it do to the ecology? Ecology is a very inward these days. It's the relationship of all life forms. And if you jazz up one part of the cycle, you may jazz up the whole cycle. Or if you knock out one sort of species, you may jazz up the works, you see. And maybe it's on its way down the tubes. Well, I had a poem here. Wonder what I did with it. This is a Bombardier, yes.
Hydrocarbon power plants also have to be cooled.
That's right, yeah. Other power plants, yeah.
It's not unique to nuclear power.
No, that's right. So, but because we're getting so many more of them, on electrical generating capacity, I don't know if you realize it, if you look around the United States today and think of all the electrical power we have, at the present time it's doubling every 10 years. I mean, in the next 10 years, or 12, it'll probably be double what it is now. And that takes a lot of doing, you know.
Hey, Bill?
Yes?
What's the potential for the solar energy use?
Yeah, the question is, can we use solar energy to better effect? Well, there's Farrington Daniels has done a lot of thinking about this, and I don't know. There has been a good deal of research into this, and of course it's used in quite a few places on Earth. In India, for example, I mean, you know, these parabolic things, they cook some of their meals on it. In a lot of places, of course, you can't utilize it. There's even been some suggestions, I guess, to put something out in space and collect it. We are using, of course, solar energy in quite a few of our space vehicles. They've improved them considerably to complement batteries and also nuclear power sources in space. But I don't think of very many breakthroughs that we can get in there. In some areas, probably we can do some desalting of water. Perhaps you have something to say about that.
At present, I know something about this. At present, it's far too expensive to compete with conventional power plants or nuclear power plants. And also, the sun's energy is spread out quite a bit. So to build a really big solar power plant, you have to have many square miles of collecting area. I don't think we can afford the space for it, really.
Unless we do it up in space or something.
Yeah, and there the then you've got a transmission. Space makes it
we haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, that's too far out and too expensive to even consider now. Mainly, it's just too expensive. You would, you know, make your electric bills 10 times what they are if we went to, or at least if you went to solar power.
And this is probably a good time to interject this thing. Because whenever you evaluate any of these developments, you have to balance the risk or the cost of it in all facets versus the benefit. How much are you willing to pay? And it comes down to this, doesn't it? Now we go into air, because I want some time for discussion. And I introduced this with aching head and plugged up sinus should be sufficient to remind us that man's horse sense has been diluted to let the air get so polluted. That's great poetry. I should have wore my button, support your local poet today, but I didn't dare. You know, for many years, and I think some of us, not very many of us now, you realize all this air that's about us. There's so many tons of it up there. And you can fly over parts of the country and see such clear air. But then where most of the people live, it's gotten so that in some places not really consistent with good life. There was a ad by the Citizens for clean air, and it said, "Tomorrow morning when you get up, take a nice deep breath. It will make you feel awful." You know? And I don't know, some of you who live in L.A., I sometimes have to go down there. And out to Pasadena, for example, it used to be such a lovely area. And boy, it's kind of awful now. Clean air is man's most urgent demand. I mean, we can go without food for quite a while, water for a little less time. But air, we can't really do very well without it for very long. In 4 days in 1948, in Donora, Pennsylvania, some of you remember it, half of the population became sick because of a smog situation, and it killed quite a few. In 4 days in 1952 in London, 4,000 people were killed. In 15 days in 63 in New York City, they claim that 400 were killed due to the unusually unfavorable air conditions. But the thing that really happens is it kills a lot of other people, but more slowly, so that the death certificates don't usually read, "died due to air pollution." But it does certainly contribute to our situation. Now, what are the sources of these? Well, you've already figured out for cars, but there again, we don't really do it right. In California, and I guess here and maybe in other places now, you're having smog devices on, which is supposed to reduce it quite a bit. But a lot of people, they figure out how to bypass them, because it sort of cuts down the economy, Mine won't hurt it any. We burn garbage in a lot of places. And although there's a burning ban here, but Bill will probably have something to say about this when he's up flying. He can show you what the burning ban does or who's paying attention to that. But in some places, of course, they do make it stick. It irritates our eyes, our nose, and our throat. It aggravates certain lung conditions. And it's a stress on the heart, and it contributes probably to lung cancer. We're producing automobiles about twice as fast as we're producing babies. And both of them, are contributing really to our problems. There again, you have to balance benefits versus other things. We on another session we'll probably discuss the population explosion and population control and what we're facing, say, in your lifetime. Now, I don't think dwell much on this, except to state another thing that some of you may not be so aware of, because like I said the other night, everything is more complex than it seems to most people. And there again, it's this situation where you have somebody gets real uptight about some other facets of it. They say, well,
If you have a lot of carbon monoxide in the air, that will decrease the sun's heat to the area. But over against this is the increase in carbon dioxide. And with the increase in population, the increase of burning of hydrocarbon fuels, and burning all the things we do, we are increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, which of course is necessary for cycling within our ecology and our ecosystems, and it's also absorbed by the ocean. But the net result of it is what we call a greenhouse effect. It absorbs the infrared and it sort of holds the heat. It's like a greenhouse, you see? And this is going to end up increasing the temperature. Probably in the lifetime of many of you, probably not me, but many of you, the temperature will probably increase over the Earth about 7 degrees. Now that may not be a good thing. We already see an increase in temperature. We know that some of the animals, the sea animals, for example, the warming of the ocean, I mean, they're establishing, well, for a given area, there's a different biota. We know that the ice cap is melting in many areas. In Scandinavia, for example, there are areas that always had snow and ice on them, no longer have snow and ice. And if for the next 100 years, if you're investing in beach property, I'm not so sure if it's a long, it's a good long-term risk, since there may be an increase of sea level. Or as one fellow said, maybe it's a good thing we have this, because if we do get a melt of the snow, of the ice cap, the polar ice caps, it may increase the sea level about 100 feet, and that'll take care of New York City and Los Angeles, and that's two of our big problems. Now, I should also say that when we discuss this air contamination situation, that it isn't restricted only to these big cities that I've just been talking about. Somebody, if you've gone through Missoula, Montana some time ago, you know it used to say big sky country? Somebody's crossed out the big and put dirty sky country. Missoula is one of the worst smoke and smog problems in the country. And it isn't one of the, you know, the bustling metropolises as far as people goes. I don't mean to insult you people from that area, but it's a lovely area. But you've got a real problem. Or Denver, you know, it used to say, boy, come up here, you know, really the mile high city with the clean air. Now it's a greasy, dirty city. The roses shrivel. They have more sinus trouble in most places. And you have to wash your curtains every other week, or maybe it's every week now. So I think we can say that probably almost every city with 50,000 people or more have a problem serious enough to be concerned about. So that's that situation. Now, before I depart from this to look at something else, I think we should talk about pesticides, just briefly. Now there's probably around 900 basic chemicals from which we get a lot of other chemicals, some of them very complex, that have been utilized now for quite a few years. And they're used in fantastic amounts, and it's sort of like medicine, you know. If a little bit does pretty good, you use a lot of it and it does better. And some of them are very short-acting and highly toxic. Some of them are live a long time and have a low toxicity demand. Now you must realize in the development of these chemicals, what are you looking for? You're looking for something that has species specificity. In other words, something, for example, if you're trying to kill an ant, that sort of just takes care of ants and doesn't do much for anything else, and certainly is non-toxic to man. Now sometimes you can't find something like this. So you have to get something that's not too toxic for man, or else you put a big warning on it so that somebody doesn't inadvertently take it. But unfortunately that always doesn't work. As I've often said, You can make things foolproof, but you can't make them damn foolproof. You know, and some of us sometimes act like damn fools, you know. And we also have things in our home which we probably, and we buy them off the shelf, which we really shouldn't have in our home, where little children can get at them. On DDT, I should say something about that, because that's really a hot issue now. It's a hot issue in our state. I mean, people say we must ban DDT, you know, wipe it out. Of course, I mean, politicians and everyone, they like simple answers, you know. And it's black and white, it's kind of handy. You know, you can do it. Well, I'm not so sure of this. As you know, DDT lives a long time. It's kind of hard to degrade, and if it degrades, it goes to something we call DDE, and which is toxic, especially to the lower forms. And it's had some unfavorable effects on our wildlife, on our bird life, in the development of the egg, and so we have a loss of probably quite a few animals from this. So what's the answer? Do you just wipe it out? On the other hand, we must realize that in the ridding of many pests, DDT was a salvation. In the areas where I was in World War II, where typhus was a real problem, it has in fact saved many, many lives, literally probably thousands of lives, because of the pests that it's gotten rid of. Of course, on the other hand, you can say, well, now a lot of the, because of the some of the biological laws that Barbara Collins has told you about, the diversity in the organisms, some of them are able to withstand this. In fact, some of them, with some of these chemicals, they build up a tolerance. In fact, some of them starts to get so they like it. But with DDT, unfortunately, it does accumulate. And there's a lot of argument today, is it toxic to man, you know? And you always want to, you know, when you read about these things, you want to, you know, have tongue-in-cheek on it, you know? And I hear scientists, they get so worked up about it. You know, they say, boy, it's doing all this, and we don't know, it may be toxic to man. We don't have any data. Well, we do have quite a bit of data. I mean, we haven't lined up a lot of people, you know, and fed them DDT over a long period of time, you know, on measured amounts. But I want to throw this in, more or less to keep your tongue in your cheek, but realizing it's still an open question, perhaps. But there is, I think there's a DDT manufacturing plant down in the LA area. It's been going, I think, since World War II, or probably at the time of the World War II, they were producing it then. And some people have worked there for all these years since that time. They have one of the best health records of any set of workers. And the stuff, you can go along and wipe it off the walls. In fact, when they first got there, you get rumors like this, and I'm just putting it out as a rumor, because the medical physician there told me about it. He said that when they first got there, and after people had been working there a while, some people who had never had children before started having children. I said, boy, that's great stuff, you know, and they brought some home to their friends who weren't working there. Boy, this is great stuff, you know. And it was also interesting that in evaluating the tumor incidence in this population, although it's a small population, and they've looked at quite a few of these DDT populations, sorry, and wondered, you know, is this true that they have a lower tumor incidence? Is there something here, you see? Of course, that doesn't mean that it might have other unfavorable effects, because we know of several things like this. If you have, for example, sickle cell anemia, you probably won't take malaria, but you feel pretty lousy. And so we have these complex kind of situations. But we have a fairly long exposure now to this, and it takes quite a bit, as far as we know, to have an effect. But you all want to be always aware of the sort of bell-shaped curve, which is the distribution of our population. If you plot numbers here on this axis and here, sort of their sensitivity to a given thing, or your height or anything, you know? I mean, some are tall and some are short. Some are very sensitive to certain agents. Some are very, do not respond to it, except with very high doses. And then there's a large population in here. But my feelings on DDT is that it's probably one of the less toxic things to man that we have in our home, if we could have it in our home and watch its use. But when you get it out in large quantities into our biota, then that's a different problem. And then you have a real problem. I predict that probably a lot of the manufacturing companies or the industry probably say, well, let them erase it, you know, because it isn't a great money-making thing now anyway. I mean, there are other things they make more money on. But the amount of pesticides we're putting out today are really fantastic. I think this year they predict what? $1.7 billion investment in these various pesticides. And you can come to my house, I can go to yours, you know. There's one for everything, you know. Get it off the shelf, you know. And so that's just that one thing on noise. And that's some of you probably get used to it. It's become quite a problem in certain industries today. And we know that there are effects from it. And in fact, it can really get us. There's some very interesting things about this, which I will not go into now. The utilization of noise for controlling mobs and so forth. But I mean, you get to a certain point when you can't stand it anymore. I mean, if you're not taking these exercises Joanne told you about in the last hour, you know, it's gonna get you. Like the garbage man at 5 a.m, you know, wham, bam, you know. There was an incident in New York City where this fellow, I mean, that was the end, you know, and he went out in his nightshirt, you know, and he actually picked up this garbage man, put him head first right in the garbage can. You know? I mean, you get to that point, and that's noise pollution. And right now we have, I think, a serious problem in some of the youngsters and some of the oldsters who like this noisy so-called music we have today. And some of you have it on all the time, you know, and it's sort of, I think you look at it as sort of white noise that wipes out everything else. But I think you will see that this generation that is now growing up, who listens to this, will have a serious defect, a hearing loss, which is already detectable. And which will probably be serious before they're as old as I am. Probably half as old as I am. It will be very noticeable. They've done studies in animals on this, but they've also checked kids who do a lot of this listening. So it is a health hazard, and it also makes life unpleasant.
Could you comment a little on the use of antibiotics as additives to animal production?
Yes. This is and as you know, it's really up for a lot of argument today. You know, people have found that if you put low amounts of certain of the antibiotics in foods, chickens, poultry, and so forth, you're going to have less disease, at least for a period of time. And if you wash the chicken or dip it in an antibiotic solution, it'll last longer. Might not taste as well for long, but it'll last longer. And so you have a greater food production per dollar. But this is not an unmixed blessing, because you can build up a sensitivity or a tolerance to these, or you can, there's more people, and I think Dr. Larson can tell you more about this than I do, but you get unfavorable reactions. I mean, they become sensitive to these because of exposures earlier. I mean, a lot of milk today, I mean, the farmer, I mean, he puts a lot of, the cow even looks like it's cross-eyed or looking the wrong way, you know. He pulls the penicillin or streptomycin off the shelf and either puts it in the udder or injects it or something, you know. And so you have this thing where you are not only maybe increasing the number of people who might be allergic to these kind of things, but you're reducing their effectiveness so that when the person really needs it, it may not, you may not either be able to use it, or it'll have an untoward effect, or will not have an effect. There are certain organisms today, for example, who at one time, I mean, streptomycin might get them, or penicillin might get them, now require it. There are certain, you can raise them so they need it. So you have this change in the biota due to the presence of these. And then we could probably also go into the hormones that are used to as pellets in the animals. And there, of course, we have the Delaney Amendment to contend with, where you can't use anything that has ever produced cancer in any experimental animal. On another day here, when I'm here, we will discuss the use of experimental animals. This is very pertinent to this whole situation. But I'm here to tell you that, I mean, a lot of these experiments have been done on rats, and you can produce cancer in a rat with almost anything. For example, I'll give you a very good example of this, like selenium. Now, we know that selenium is toxic if given in high amounts, but it isn't been until the very recent past that we realized it's a required element, you know. There's some very early work on some rats in which selenium was said to have caused tumors. So the Food and Drug Administration was faced then. Here's something that's required, yet it maybe causes cancer. Well, this is true for quite a few agents, of course. Cobalt is a requirement. You can inject cobalt, get tumors probably. I probably didn't answer. You probably have some more to say about this.
No, I think you touched on the pertinent things. I think it's a little comical. We have this tremendous furor raised about fluoride, which is a very controversial variable. We've got very clear-cut evidence that deaths occur from anaphylactic reactions of people who have been unknowingly sensitized to drugs through foods because of this policy in animals. And then a physician gives penicillin to a patient and they die from an anaphylactic reaction. And the suspicion at least is very strong that the sensitization occurred from some source of food.
That's right.
Because this is the most common exposure that they have unknowingly.
I was going to say one other thing about DDT. It's completely apart from this. But that when you read and evaluate these things, you know, they say, well, there's a certain amount in the milk, you know. There's so many parts per million, you know. Unless you really know what this means, I mean, you may be led astray. You know, people were so concerned, well, there's a certain amount of DDT in the milk. Well, as far as the hazard demand, the levels that are there at very low levels probably do not have an effect.
The status, to give a very thorough study of the status of the water in Lake Superior at present and contamination suspected to be occurring, and I say suspect because this is a problem at present being studied and in fact has been exposed now to an enforcement hearing under the Department of Interior. The biggest source of suspect contamination in the lake relates to a major industry in northern Minnesota, the taconite industry. In 1947, Reserve Mining put a large plant with state and federal permission on the shore of Lake Superior, and they are dumping 60,000 tons of tailings into the lake each day, the year round. This is going into a huge trough that I believe is about 800 feet deep. It is rock that has been crushed. It's a very finely ground up rock. Some of it actually appears to now form a colloidal suspension. And the concern is that this is beginning to spread through the lake. The evidence for this is at present not solid, but that's being studied. And the effects of this insoluble rock are the matter of concern to ecologists because it has been maintained that this is insoluble, therefore it's just like dumping any rock, a big boulder, into the lake. This is not accepted by everyone today. Of course, it's a disputed issue. The water laboratory is undertaking very careful and detailed studies, particularly on the life cycle of the trout, because the lake trout was at one time a major industry in the Great Lakes overall. They've been wiped out through a combination of things, probably. The lamprey played a major role. Some suspect that commercial fishing also played a major role. Whatever the major factors were, they're depleted, but they're coming back. And the concern is, will they come back if we continue to contaminate the lake and possibly destroy the life cycle that is essential for the early trout to feed? And this is presently being studied. I think some very interesting findings are going to be coming forth publicly within the next year. Some of them were already publicized in a hearing in April. This was suspended for 6 months, and they will be meeting again in the fall. And I ultimately suspect that the U.S. government, through this enforcement hearing, will force a major industry to change their policies. This is just my personal suspicion. Of course, this is a very controversial issue because it's $250 million investment, and there's a community of 5,000 people totally dependent upon this company, and the company has threatened to close up their operations if they have to change because they say it's economically unfeasible. These are the economic pressures, of course, that authorize this kind of an issue.
Yeah, and that's what I want to bring out, but that the U.S. government, they are putting money into it. They are trying to do something about it, and on these water labs they've set up, and so they are trying to do something about it. Now, because some of us say, well, the government isn't doing anything about it. The other thing is, well, industry did this, and they better clean up, you know, and they're not doing it. They're causing this and this. Now, of course, you, by demanding a certain product for a certain price, you essentially force them into it. But now I'd like to have a couple of people, you know, tell about, well, what is industry doing sort of about this? In one case here with Bill Roche, who is with Washington Water Power, and sort of, well, what are they doing about it? And then, are you Lawrence? You're Lawrence, aren't you? No, you're...
Rudy Cummings.
Okay. I got it mixed up with somebody. From Toledo, and then he's going to tell a little bit about it.
Okay. Hydroelectric power has been the mainstay of the Pacific Northwest. It's been one of our great assets, the water resources we have. But at the present time, I believe all but one site for hydroelectric power in the Northwest. We have one site left, which is quite controversial, our High Mountain Sheep down the Snake River, is the only available source of economical hydroelectric power left. So the Washington Water Power Company is in the process of building a coal-fired electrical generating plant in Centralia, Washington. The problems today in doing something, we're strip mining coal over there. We have many thousand acres of low-grade coal laying on the surface. Now, two choices. You can end up with something, as our tailings out here look like, or you can, as the plans are going there, this will be strip lined in 300-foot wide strips. The overburden will be lifted off. The coal down, as far as you can economically lift it out, will be taken out. And the overburden will be put back in. This will be reforested, grasses, natural plants, irrigated, and brought back. So as you bring each strip out, you'll take your overburden off behind, move your coal out in front, bring your overburden back in, and reforest and replant this. The attempt to leave as little damage or scarring to the area, which is a beautiful country over there, as you can. The steam plant itself, first of all, you require water. You've got to have a source of water. The Skookumchuck River is being dammed up near its source, and one valley is being cleared, and this will become a reservoir from which the steam plant will draw water. The water from the steam plant will go into a separate reservoir for a completely closed cycle. Our cooling steam for generating will never go back into the Skookumchuck River. Okay, you've got problems with your coal, you've got your fly ash. These all have to be precipitated out. And the big mammoth precipitators are being put in, along with the architect that's trying to build a aesthetically pleasing plant. We have to have this plant. There's no, like you say, we're doubling our demand for power every 10 years. So they'll precipitate this out. Of course, the fly ash, the light ash that goes up the chimney will be used, has some uses commercially insulation and other things, they can't sell this. And this all sounds very simple, but the years of work and planning that have gone into it, and the amount of money where you come, when you're a stockholding company required to show a profit, the amount of money that this costs to control your pollution. I mean, this isn't a, the way you explain it, what they're going to do sounds very simple, but it's not. This is the cost alone, prior to ever generating 1 kilowatt of power, to try to return the land to what it is. It is staggering.
Well, is a precipitator, that's the...
Above your burner, so this precipitates out all the solids out of your...
It's kind of like a re-burner, isn't it?
I'm not an engineer, I can't...
I thought it was something to, you know, like the little particles of...
This doesn't re-burn, this takes... it uses, I believe, a static or...
Yeah, electrostatic precipitators. I know in some cases they use them.
Oh, yeah. Very effective. Let's say visualizing a smoke stack instead of a black smoke going out, then it'll be kind of just a...
We'll have gray. There'll be, actually, there'll be nothing coming out of the top of this chimney. I mean, visible. There will be gases. This isn't 100, this is about 94-95% effective. You still, it's within the technology, it's impossible, at least in this particular case, to remove everything.
Was that an expensive thing?
Very expensive.
Depends on what efficiency you're going to, boy, and that last few percent cost like sin. And I think most of you know what that costs. Now, you know, we were discussing on the boat.
And water and power.
Yeah, but you see, yeah. You know, the point I'm trying to make here is that, I mean, you know, you can say, well, these are culprits and those are culprits. But really, when it comes down to it, we have engaged the enemy, and it is us, you know. Yeah. Yes?
I work with an oil company. It's an oil company in Toledo. We have had secondary treatment of all our wastewater for the last 15 years, getting about 90% removal of the organics that are present in the water, 99% of the phenolics. We are now working on the final polishing to get rid of some of that last 10%. Incidentally, the blue pike are coming back in Lake Erie. I do not feel it is entirely dead. The perch fishing is tremendous.
That's good.
I think it will live. The program around the Lake Erie is that by 1971, secondary treatment will be used in all municipal and industrial plants. Some industries have dragged back much more than the oil industry has, incidentally. I have one parting thought I'd like to give. We in industry can clean up the water as clean as you, the consumer, desire. All it will do, as long as all competitive industry is treated fairly, we can clean it up and you, the consumer, will pay the price of it.
Yeah. That's the critical issue, you see. You see, because this is what, I mean, if you're in business, if you're in industry, I mean, and if your competitor has this advantage where he doesn't have to do it, you're dead in the water, you know. I mean, you're no longer in business. Because you, that's right, the profits are shot, you see.
This is one of the reasons I think that federal regulations are so essential, because as long as we've got varying regulations in states, we have an impossible situation. You haven't a fair competitive situation then.
Right. Some of
you can say, well, one of your competitors in the next state has got a tremendous advantage over us, and you're right.
Or certain industries.
Or certain industries.
Yeah, you see, and we still have that favoritism shown in government, you see. So we as the tax-paying and also voting public, we must make ourselves heard on this.
Industry is not... industry, of course, is the big enemy. Industry dumps big piles of pollution. We all see this.
Yeah.
But everybody is guilty in this case, because we're all... It's not correct. We have to correct old habits. This didn't occur overnight. This has been occurring for 1,000 years.
And we're going to have to give up some of our conveniences.
That's right.
I mean, a lot of these disposable containers, I think we're going to have to knock them out and use reusable containers, or have them to be either, we have to go down and come in, continue using them, or have them used for something else. Yes?
Talk about the government, kind of came out, and he said it was a detergent pack that we had in our sewer from the dishwasher and detergents and all. And that's over a year ago. And he said 5 years from now, he said that the government is absolutely going to outlaw every detergent. Of course, I'm not using detergent anymore after having that. But he said the government, now what he knows, I don't know.
Well, they're going to what we call, I called it a minute ago,
biodegradable.
Yeah, biodegradable, you know. Yeah. And we should all use those. Right?
Now, what are the biodegradable?
It's dash.
Like oil and dash and those things?
It usually says on the label, you know.
All.
Amway.
What kind do you use? Amway products, yeah, are all.
Amway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your Shackley products.
I just want to say, I just met a man last 2 weeks ago. He's on the church council. He's the head chemist up in Detroit on water. And he's also involved in disposal of garbage and trash and so on. And is he ever hot on this business of plastic bags and garbage pails? He says, you can't get rid of that stuff. You don't know what to do with it. And while it makes your garbage pails so nice and clean, you know, with oil, it doesn't make the country clean.
Well, it's similar to when this economy thing comes in here, the big thing against cigarette smoking will affect the people that grow tobacco and that make the cigarettes and everything else. And then how much of an impact would the plastic industry have against them?
I think I might say one more thing about this situation of Lake Superior. It may have sounded like I was anti-industry. I was merely trying to point out the pressures here that occur. And I think that your point's very valid. The reserve mining finds themselves in a very tough situation now. They were given state and federal privileges to dump their tailings in this area. So their whole process was set up on this setup. All the other taconite plants that we have developed in the last 5 years in northern Minnesota, since they modified the state constitution and gave them some tax privileges, made other provisions. And they are in a competitive position with Reserve, who happened to make this particular move. If Reserve now has to change their policy, it's going to be a very expensive operation for them. To me, it seems inconceivable that they will dump it, but it's going to put them in a very tough spot for a while if they have to modify their dumping procedure.
What is their alternative?
Their alternative is only one, and that is to, well, it's possibly two. One has been suggested that they might build a great big holding area out in the lake and let the sediment settle out and get rid of this colloidal suspension, which seems to be the major concern if this bears out. And this is still in the investigative stage. I want to make that clear. There's been no formal accusation at this moment, but it's been suspect. That, however, seems economically unfeasible to them. The other alternative they have is to put huge carriers, conveyor belts, and to haul this all over a huge hill and dump it back in the land. And this is a distance of several miles and quite an elevation. And this would be a very expensive thing. But it is feasible. I don't know if it's economically feasible. It's technically feasible. But of course, they have to concern themselves with the economics because they're in a very competitive industry. And they're competing with other plants in the northern part of the state that have made other provisions.
Okay, we'll continue our discussion around the tree. I'll close with this one line. We are often unable to tell people what they want to know because they want to know something else. That's George McDonald.